You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking about a great new book. It's an expose of the companies that control your food supply, titled Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. A great investigational piece of journalism by our guest, Austin Frerich. And Austin, you've gotten some wonderful kudos for your book. All you know, very important people in the field of nutrition have lauded it. Marion Nestle, who's a distinguished professor at New York University and author of What to Eat and Food Politics, has said, "Wow, this is one important book."
Yeah, that was a cool one. I remember when I got that because I sent her a copy. I didn't know it was coming. I landed literally in Iowa, coming back from a conference, and all of a sudden, my publisher sent me this email and to read, you know, I was reading on the tarmac and it was, I mean, Marion Nestle is such a legend, like you said.
Yeah, she's an icon. She says, if you want to know how corporations control the food supply, start here. So great, great primer. And, you know, I don't think the book, it's not encyclopedic enough to call out all the forces within American government in collusion with industrialists. But you do a good job of using kind of a case study method of using, you know, industry by industry, the dairy industry, the berry industry, which I didn't realize was such a monolithic industry, the grain industry, the hog industry, beef, et cetera. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some perverse incentives for this. You know, we did talk about agricultural policies, which encourage people to grow more of stuff that goes into ultra-processed foods, like sugar, like corn, like wheat. Those commodities, soy, these things tend to be ultra-cheap, and then we have to fashion them into ultra-processed foods. But there's also governmental programs, such as the SNAP program, which, again, best of intentions, you know, support, underserved communities, families that are impoverished, children that go hungry. There's even a big school lunch program, but the USDA and government agencies that administer these programs, they're not very selective about the kind of nutrition that they subsidize, right?
You don't think Lunchables are healthy to feed our children as a school meal?
No, I mean, yeah, they were just featured as but they're modified Lunchables. They're a little bit better than regular Lunchables. Yeah.
I mean, you said the key phrase there, the best of intentions. So that's the story of so many of these structures. They start off with good things. I mean, even that conservation program we talked about earlier. Now you can get conservation dollars and use it to build those hog manure lagoons.
Right.
That to me is, never forget the system we have now is radical. And a lot of these solutions people talk about, people work towards, are actually very traditional. Like, who doesn't want kids having healthy food grown locally served from someone paying a decent wage? The fact that we're feeding our kids Brazilian Amazon rainforest beef is like truly bonkers.
Mm-hmm. Especially when, you know, we talk about, climate change and the devastation of forestry and so on. We are really sacrificing the world's ecosystem, destroying our soil integrity on the altar of profits, basically.
And I would just add on taste. I mean, that's the other thing too. Like,
right.
Taste has collapsed in the system. This system was not engineered for taste. That Driscoll berry is engineered for durability, for long shelf life. The berry grower on the, Walmart doesn't want to handle with one berry grower down the street that makes a fresh tasting berry. It wants that. I mean, even writing my milk chapter, I would do a little milk tastings, and inputs matter, especially in the meat and dairy production. And when the animals are inside a metal shed all day eating corn, they're just not going to make a good product.
And by the way, and we actually, science shows the taste, especially when it comes to vegetables and fruits, is a signature of their content of beneficial polyphenols. So it's not merely an aesthetic thing. It actually, we are guided by our senses to seek out food that is very integrated to our biological processes, you know, like a lock and key fitting into our systems. And we're creating foods that suit the purposes of durability, shelf life, transportability, and appearance, frankly, because, you know, I can't tell you how many berries I've bitten into that look super good.
Yeah.
But they kind of taste like cardboard.
Oh, totally. I mean, even Fairlife is a fascinating one. So that's my dairy baron, the one Coke executive. It's twice the price of milk for half the volume. But like when I do milk tastings, industrial milk always gets last. Pasture milk, the traditional way we did milk, people love it or they hate it. Sometimes it's too creamy for some people. Fairlife usually wins. And it's because, I mean, that thing was engineered for like a decade. You know, it was designed to hit the right senses. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's like the dark undercurrent of a lot of this stuff is it's manipulating these different biological, you know, things inside of us.
Right. Scientists using functional MRIs will do taste testings in, you know, special laboratories to concoct the various flavors that ultimately appeal to our hypothalamus. At the same time, we use drugs to tune down the cravings that prompt us to eat those foods. It's kind of a paradox. What can we do to, this looks like a juggernaut. And, you know, it's not a matter of like, vote this party, vote that party. I mean, yes, some parties on the margins may propose solutions, but they all seem to be at the beck and call of these very, very powerful industrial entities. So how do we as consumers and citizens make a difference?
Yeah. That's both the scary, I mean, it's easy to be dark here, how broken these systems are. But to me, the hope here is just, there's so much of what the system could be. I mean, that's kind of what I personally want to focus on now is neither party is particularly in a positive vision, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the biggest thing we can do is actually put animals back on the land. And the Biden administration is actually really helping in this direction in that it's been really aggressive at transitioning the American auto fleet to hybrids and electric vehicles, which will kill ethanol. Ethanol now is the single largest use of corn in America. It's going to die. The industry's freaking out. They're trying to put in airplanes for that reason. But you should start thinking now, but what are we going to do? We don't need that farmland. And that's my goal, is to take animals out of these metal sheds, put them on the land.
Mm-hmm.
Because to be frank, most grain production will be robotics. And that's not bad.
Right.
But it's like a person can only look after so many dairy cows. So that's one thing. The other thing is, and I kind of mentioned this earlier, is sunsetting the farm bill. I just think the farm bill is too corrupted. It's too far gone. The current system actually makes, you know, doesn't make healthy food. It's bad for the climate. And you're actually seeing it become a bipartisan thing where they can't even pass a status quo farm bill because even members of the Republican Party think crop insurance is too gluttonous. And so I would separate the farm bill from the food stamps program, have them be two different things. And I just think if you did that, the farm bill collapsed within itself, because the dirty secret is industry hollowed out its voter base. I mean, you set tons of family farms in Iowa, and now, you know, 10 entities control 70% of the hog supply. And the other big thing to me is focus on procurement. As we kind of phase out this old industrial system, you have to build up a new system. And I think, you know, schools, universities, jails, prisons, they buy a lot of food. And so use them to be drivers of a positive system change. It's good politics. Who doesn't want, you know, all dairy served in Wisconsin coming from pasture dairy farms? You keep your money local.
So you're for local sustainable farming and community farming and returning, you know, to a more traditional methods of raising foods.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to almost rewind these last few decades where things just got really off the rails. I mean, that's my big thing. And this isn't, and it's better for the climate. I mean, it's, who isn't happy after a good meal too? I mean, there's a lot of things. To me, this is a part of a bigger thing to take the temperature down.
Indeed. Also, you know, there is this movement to, you know, virtually curtail animal food consumption. You know, it is thought that this is a big contributor to climate change, global warming via methane. You know, certainly there's a lot of methane produced in those lagoons. Cow eructations are a source of methane. So the notion is we need to come up with faux meats. But you don't seem to be behind that impetus. I mean, a lot of people who are progressive these days suggest that abolishing animal agriculture is an important goal.
I would, let me step back. To me, dairy's the best example of this and why it's so bad for the climate. Here's the thing. We're drinking less and less milk, but our dairy consumption is going up because we're eating more cheese and ice cream. Like, that's not healthy for you. Why are, and you also have parts of USDA saying, literally saying, eat more ice cream. And so much of the dairy production, industrial dairy, is done in regions that just aren't sustainable for the climate, like Bakersfield. Like, New Mexico does 3 times more dairy than Vermont, and that's just comically illogical.
Because of the dearth of water, but providing artificial water supplies to some of these regions ultimately is, it's not going to play out. It's not sustainable.
And you're starting to see them move. They're starting to, industrial dairy is slowly collapsing in the West. So they're trying to move back to the Midwest. That said, I mean, just what's even going back to, you mentioned digesters. When a cow's on pasture and she defecates, she's fertilizing her feed. When you put her inside, you have to use fossil fuel to grow her feed. When you pull her manure, it creates additional methane. So this industrial dairy model is actually even more destructive to the climate. Right. So to also say, to keep in mind, even going to go to pork, we're producing more and more pork, but Americans aren't eating more pork. 1 in 3 is for export. So why in that? Like, why are we doing that? Why are we destroying rural Iowa to feed, you know, predominantly China? Because that's like their main protein. So I would start there. And also keep in mind, everything you eat is subsidized. And the question is, to what degree? Would the climate change, I mean, the climate crisis would require us to change our diets, but our diets are always changing. We didn't eat chicken that much just a few decades ago. I mean, chicken strips are actually the best example of neoliberalism to me.
Uh-huh.
There's no flavor. You hide it, you bread it. And that whole model of chicken production is, you know, rooted in sharecropping. And so that's that, we will have to change our diets for the climate. But to me, I'd rather start with these simple, obvious things. And keep in mind,
I mean, in other words, what you're saying is that chickens aren't the equivalent of the traditional American cattle or bison that roamed across the plains. They can't be part of a like a monumental ecosystem that used to be the way that things were in the pre-Columbian era, when we had grass feeding bison and, you know, the cycle of nature was perpetuated, and Native Americans partook of the bison, but in kind of a conservational way where they didn't decimate the herds, and, you know, it was an ecosystem.
Yeah, it was understanding you have to manage an ecosystem. I mean, this is such a simple thing. There was that movie that won the best award for best movie at the Oscars. You know, the one with the deaf family at a fishing village? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Keep going on that. No, I might have missed that.
Anyways, I just remember a scene in there where, like, the fishermen are going broke. It's a New England family.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I do. But then,
I saw bits and pieces of that, yeah.
To your listeners out there, I'm so sorry I forgot the title of that movie.
Yeah,
this is so simple. I noticed in the cafeteria scene of his daughter, they were serving sausage pizza. And you're like, our diets should be more regional in America than they are. You know, that should be, the students in that area in New England should have a more fish-based diet, as people in Iowa probably could eat more pork. I think just to kind of step back, though, is the homogenization to a food culture in America. And because it's also local places maintain local identity, local culture. And it just doesn't make sense for these supply chains. So, like, what people eat in New Mexico are going to be different than upstate Maine. We just have to accept that. And people want that. I mean, it's not, there's a whole thing about refrigeration changed a lot of this, but this doesn't make sense moving forward.
Right. So, okay, well, practically speaking, I'm actually president of an organization called the Alliance for Natural Health, and we actually fight on a variety of fronts. We are against crony capitalism in medicine, in agriculture, and we also are big believers in organic and sustainable agriculture. So our mission statements really coincide. It's a citizens group. It's a grassroots group. But are there other avenues for people to get involved politically and, you know, perhaps talk to their local legislators, national legislators,
You know, I'm not sure voting for one or another presidential candidate is going to be the thing.
Yeah. I mean, push so many legislators just are don't have positions on this stuff. I encourage you to push them to do that. And this is like a simple little thing you can even do locally. I don't think most people realize a lot of, especially in the Corn Belt, a lot of suburbs strip off the soil. They sell it before they start building homes. Mandate that you have to maintain soil, because like that's what happens is a lot of people then move to suburbs where their soil's been stripped off, can't garden in their backyard. I mean, that's very common in Iowa, actually. And like, what a simple little thing just to have 6 or 7 inches of topsoil still in your backyard so you could grow your own green beans or whatever. I mean, it's such a simple, overlooked idea, but it's so huge.
Yeah. This is something that people can do on a small scale mm-hmm. with private gardens, community gardens, you know, carving out green spaces that enable them to, you know, even grow ornamental plants and, you know, make sure that there's enough greenery to absorb the CO2. These are some things that can be done.
Totally. And I just add on, you reminded me like our conversation earlier about that Driscoll PR fluffy journalist story.
Yep.
Never underestimate the power you have to send a personal email to a journalist being like, hey, you missed this story, or this person you're quoting isn't disclosing some of their shenanigans, or maybe doing, or like, hey, you should know about this. I think an underappreciated thing right now in this moment is how much the industry capture of land grants, as we privatized it, industrial dollars filled the void. And so many of the people with fancy titles, like the hog chair of Iowa State, are really in the pocket of industry. So as people are giving, you know, they have fancy sounding titles, they really shape the discourse, the public square, but they're really just hacked for industry. And letting journalists know is huge. I mean, that is, or even telling them, this is kind of a raunchy example, but like in Western Iowa, you know that Mulcher scene in Fargo?
Okay. I am a Fargo fan. Okay. Keep going.
But you know the mulch scene?
The mulch, the famous mulching scene. Yeah. That's become a meme.
Yes. So about 10% of hogs die inside these metal sheds. And so usually in rural Iowa, they're just a dumpster full of dead pig bodies. Well, this older woman in Western Iowa saw that a farm or someone running one of these industrial facilities was doing that mulch scene to his hogs. She called the state. The state didn't do anything. So you know what she did? She went to the press. And it's because she went to local media where, I mean, you can't, that story is seared in my head. I cannot forget it.
Right.
And that's the power of the press. I mean, that's why I want people to know.
Is and like, social media, because increasingly we can have, you know, sort of guerrilla journalists, you know, citizen journalists who can have a lot of followers and make a big impact without going through the traditional journalistic channels.
100%. I mean, that's why I opened my book with this woman named Julie Dunn. She's mm-hmm. a retired administrative assistant in rural Iowa, and she's made it her mission in retirement to fight these industrial hog facilities. She doesn't always win, but she beat a few, and it's at some point, the glass is going to crack. You just have to keep trying. It's you're never going to beat these people dollar for dollar. You got to lean into David versus Goliath narrative.
So also, I think people can vote with their consumer dollars. They can shop local. They can patronize small family-owned farms, grocery stores, the few that are left. I think that's an important consideration too, right?
It is. But I would also, I'm a little careful to overemphasize that because that's been the theory of change these last few decades. And all that does is bifurcate the system.
Yeah.
It's actually my biggest worry about these diet drugs is it'll just intensify that because like, what was it? The largest use of these diet drugs is on the Upper East Side. At least I saw that in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago. Just about like a personal example. So I went to Grinnell College, a small liberal arts in Iowa, and big endowment. And north of campus was one of the most famous organic farms in the state of Iowa. Well, they closed a few years ago. And it's like, here you have a college with a massive multi-billion dollar endowment. Mm-hmm. They could have procured its carrots from there, kept their money local, sustained that, served better tasting carrots, but instead it was, you know, buying produce from Baja California, because, you know, Cisco distributors, what have you. I mean, that's a whole other conversation of food barons. Is like a lot of these vendors to cafeterias have their own shenanigans they play, but pushing your colleges, your schools to buy from people that you think are trust that you like, help pair them up with people doing it right. I mm-hmm. mean, with the schools that can afford it.
And municipalities can do that too, you know, because there are school lunch programs that are locally based instead of selling out to big industrial concessions that, you know, are part of national food chains, you know, try to develop contracts with local purveyors.
And it's also a feel-good story, and I feel like people crave that right now. Like, I did my college theses on slaughterhouse towns in Iowa. They're mostly immigrant, they're mostly poor, and mostly undocumented. But a lot of them do this already. I mean, there's a newspaper I read, it's from like Iowa, and they tell stories of how Southeast Asians have settled there to work in the two slaughterhouses, do a lot of farming on the side, and how the school now is using lemongrass to cook. And it's also teaching students of, you know, other students of different cultures about their cuisine. Like, it's just such a, people just feel better. It just makes you, I'm all about taking the temperature down, which is a weird thing to say when you write a book about robber barons.
Yeah.
Like, I just get that sense, these last year or so. It's just people need hope. They need something to look forward to. And I think food truly is that vehicle to do it.
That's an interesting comment. As an Iowan, with deep roots in Iowa, I think there's a sense of dismay at what has happened to the traditional culture of that state. And, you know, that may be the basis for populism, you know, rightly or wrongly directed, because people just are not happy with the direction that this current, government and industrial regime has brought us to. So, you know, what about, you know, the climate in the heartland is kind of dismal, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I wrestled with this when I was writing this book, but to me, my core chapter is really my coffee baron.
Mm-hmm.
It's, they entered America coffee markets in 2012, they bought Peet's.
The Germans with Nazi roots.
Yes.
Right.
But the whole point of that chapter is I really want to tell the history of antitrust in America, but also really drive home the point, because I think it's so salient for right now, is how monopolist finance fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the history has been lost and underappreciated. Like, after World War II, Congress commissioned a report. How did this happen? And one of their big findings was that key point. So we actually, as the American military, broke up these monopolists that financed Hitler. I mean, Hitler's largest donor was a company called IG Farben. Like, Hitler would walk into the room, say, "Oh, I don't mean to create the things. I'll help you sell more chemicals."
The makers of Cyclone B, which was the gas used in the concentration camps, and continues to be an industrial giant.
It is. And the congressional report said their donation pushed him over the edge into his victory that allowed that country to go down that way. And I mean, it's not even hard to see the parallels now. I mean, we shouldn't be shocked that a strong man is trying to fill this anger void.
Yeah. And we're talking about what in a sense is an oligarchy, and the political leaders actually are just the expression of, some very, very powerful interests that wield an inordinate amount of influence. And when it comes to our food supply, I think that's where the rubber meets the road, because ultimately America's health is at stake and we're being poorly served. So that, I think, is the take-home message of the book.
That, and also I would add on the bipartisanness. That's as weird as that sounds to say. The two things that shocked me in this book and like promoting it has been, one, I've actually got a lot of attention in kind of Republican-leaning media ecosystems.
Yeah. You actually got good reviews from a conservative publication, I think.
No, that was one of my favorites, because, I mean, that was very much a goal of mine, is how do I put together a bipartisan coalition here? And then the second one has actually been the, I call it the Bloomberg crowd. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be someone attacking capital. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be that fringy lefty.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot, especially upper class Americans, they go abroad, they see a different system, they see Italy, and they're like, "Oh wait, I ate better food, it was cheaper, and I lost weight." They see it, and I've been really trying to tap into that, because this is a weird thing to say. I kind of view myself as like Elizabeth Warren and Mayor Pete packaging.
Okay.
I don't want powers that be to feel overtly scared in that. I'm really about owning the middle. I really think this, like, I don't want, because I know how they'll paint someone like me, "Oh, you're fringy, you're lefty, you want food to go up, prices to go up." You know what I mean? There's like there's a classic playbook they do to marginalize reformers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I just want to show people, I want to make them look like the fringy types. Like, "Oh, you are supporting a really radical system."
Right. So to flip the script. And, you know, I think, what's interesting is that I talk to a lot of people in this realm. And they range from, on the right of the spectrum, libertarians. There is within, the right of the Republican Party, a strong element of people who believe in local sustainable agriculture as a solution. at, you know, and more support for environmental regulations because, you know, they want clean water, air, and food. So I don't think any one party has ownership of this agenda. And I think it's important to point it out in books like you've written. So the book is Barron's. I recommend it because it's a great tutorial on how money, power, has corrupted America's food industry. And it's also a recipe for change. So thank you very much for your courageous stand in getting out there and reporting on it, because I think you made some enemies along the way, but the story needs to be told. And I also want to congratulate you. I think this is your premier book, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So congratulations on a beautifully written book and a great investigation. It's important.
Thanks again for having me on. I really appreciate talking about it.
Yeah, it's my great pleasure. Oster Frerich, and the book is Barron's, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. The book is available from the usual sources. Thanks very much for joining us, Austin. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations. Whether you're a nutrition enthusiast or simply an individual looking to improve your well-being, check out this comprehensive new course from the American Nutrition Association, Getting Started with Personalized Nutrition. It's a self-paced one-hour course with video, reference sheets, and more, all with the goal of helping you harness the power of personalized nutrition. You'll learn how to optimize your energy levels, support your mental clarity, improve your GI function, enhance your physical performance, and maintain your metabolic health. The course is regularly $49, but as an Intelligent Medicine listener, you can get access to this vital content for just $29. Just go to the ANA.org/Hoffman. That's the ANA.org/Hoffman, and use coupon code Hoffman29 for the exclusive discount. The ANA believes personalized nutrition holds the greatest potential to solve the chronic disease epidemic. Just go to the ANA.org/Hoffman and use coupon code Hoffman29 for the Harness the Power of Personalized Nutrition course.